when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shake of a sauce bottle, mate.
G'day there, Mark Kenny with another Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. I'm also with the Australian Studies Institute here at ANU and the School of Politics and International Relations, where my co-host Maria Tafaga, Dr. Maria Tafaga, comes from as well. She's a political scientist. How are you, Maria?
Very well, Mark. How are you?
I am well, although I'm starting to tire of the Canberra winter, I must say. And indeed, the sort of the kind
it's
of
been so glorious this week. I mean, it has been pretty rough until now, but
yeah,
it's been
like
beautiful.
I said, yeah, it wears a bit thin after a while. I'd like to see some leaves on the trees and a bit of warmth in the air. But anyway, no need to complain. Now, look, anyone watching events in the US at present, just as an example, can see plainly what happens when dollars drive politics and when hyper-partisanship hollows out the middle and when everything becomes political, when elections themselves in terms of the way they're run, the courts, the police, prosecutors, when everything's political, it really can feed a collapse of trust. Australia, of course, has its protections there. We have compulsory preferential voting, which is a critical sort of stabiliser, sort of forces politicians to, you know, campaign toward the middle and to seek that kind of mainstream vote. We have a federal independent electoral commission, which runs elections, so we don't have any of the sort of shenanigans we've seen in the US where state political parties tend to run the elections in the various states, and this leads to complaints or suspicion amongst voters that untoward things are happening, and that, of course, can be then leveraged and weaponized as Donald Trump has done. But we are not in Australia completely immune from polarization and from things like corruption. Of course, as we know, there are instances of that are being investigated at the moment. Disinformation continues to be a major problem. So all of these things are matters that need to be taken very seriously in Australia, even if we do have some of those institutional protections. Now, one of the people determined to do something about this is the independent member for Curtin in Perth, Kate Chaney. And I'm very pleased to say she's joined us here in Democracy Sausage. Welcome to the podcast, Kate.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's really exciting to be here.
It's great. You spend so much time on the other side of the country where you live, and we don't have people from Perth on the podcast, in the studio at least. Occasionally, have them remotely and so forth, but of course Parliament's sitting, so that makes that much easier. And as a result of Parliament sitting, or a function of it, you were able to introduce a private members bill, which you've done now. And what have you called that? You've called it...
The Restoring Trust Bill.
Yes, I like the names of these bills these days. You know, they're very descriptive. The Restoring Trust Bill. And can you just briefly tell us about what its main tenets are?
Sure. So 20 months ago, I was not a politician and had nothing to do with politics really. And it was only after that a community group asked me to run. And at that point, I really felt the declining trust that I had in politicians, and there was sort of scandal after scandal, and you start to think, oh, I'm not convinced that politicians are actually making decisions in our best interests. Mm. And what I discovered once I was involved, and especially running as an independent, was how our electoral rules end up being driven to protect the status quo, and there are a whole lot of things in there that that could be fixed. And this really underpins every other issue. So you want to know that politicians are making decisions in your best interest. So part of the bill is reducing financial influence. You want to know who's funding your candidates before you actually vote. So part of the bill is improving transparency. And you want to make sure that there is actually competition for new political ideas and candidates. So the third part is levelling the playing field to make sure that we don't just get stuck in this duopoly.
It's a really interesting point, isn't it, Maria, about this sort of protecting the status quo, because in a way, as I outlined in that introduction, we talk about our sort of institutional foundations as the great stabilisers, in a sense protectors against the kind of wild populism that we see gripping, say, the US. But it does come at a cost, and that is that within that stability, there are sort of key players who are essentially protected from challenge by a whole lot of institutional norms and rules. Things around, as Kate says, you know, donations and the special place that political parties have, and indeed the preferential system itself.
Absolutely. So in political science, we call this the cartel party thesis, which dates from the mid-90s. And the essential idea is essentially the sort of summary of the problems that Kate has identified that she wants to solve, which is that incumbent political actors essentially change laws to entrench their position and make it harder for new competitive entrants to enter. And also that what they do is they co-opt state resources, so basically money, public financing and things like that. Or, for example, in Australia, the way that parties are exempted from most privacy laws and provisions is a sort of key dimension of that. The fact that, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, they awarded themselves a lot of money to upgrade their security systems because they have accumulated lots of private information about voters, which is poorly secured. And I'm not against parties actually being able to protect this information, but it does raise the question why they are allowed to exempt themselves from normal privacy provisions whilst castigating public companies and people who have had data breaches before and, you know, without wanting to inspire hackers. It is actually an important dimension to the system's ability to renew. And if we didn't have our Senate voting system with its PR lower threshold, you do call into question whether or not we would have as many new entrants in the system over the last 40 years as we have. And I think most people would say that competition has been to the good.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating because the sorts of things that I guess you could be referring to in terms of the way they look at their rulemaking role and what those rules look like and how they are reflected in them. We think about things like redistribution of electoral boundaries. You know, the major parties tend to have quite a strong role in making submissions and being able to appeal proposed boundary changes. The Electoral Commission itself tends to have a mindset for the two-party system, you know, the distribution or the spread between marginal seats, which are up for grabs, and safe seats is crafted in such a way as to deliver a sort of level of continuity and stability in the system. Again, very much a kind of a two-party mindset. And indeed, the two-party preferred system itself makes it quite hard for new entrants such as yourself, Kate, to come in. It takes somewhat extraordinary circumstances almost to be able to break into those lower house seats.
That's right. And I think as a newcomer, you bring a naive but fresh perspective, which is often useful when you're looking at existing institutions.
Naivety is a great help when you're a candidate, actually, isn't
it? Well, you come in.
You have to sort of think you're going to win.
That's right. But you also come in and I just saw a whole lot of things and I thought, well, that's not right. That doesn't seem fair. And in business, we encourage competition and we don't like it when there's a duopoly. And in politics, I think we need to take a similar approach so that our political ideas and movements and philosophies are able to evolve and change and be open to new ideas. So having come in and I suppose, you know, one in unlikely circumstances, it does make you think, well, you know, what could there could be improved in this system? And some of those level playing field issues are addressed in my bill. So part including removing Privacy and Spam Act exemptions for political parties. Another thing is the use of government of taxpayer money to fund government ads. Now, before every election, there's a spike in government advertising, at least double, and the graph looks pretty alarming. For example, before the last election, the Coalition ran its positive energy campaign that it spent $31 million of taxpayer money trying to convince us that we weren't the worst OECD country on climate change and climate action.
I didn't feel a lot of positive energy at the time, no, I must admit.
That's right.
Oh, I'm glad they spent those resources advertising to us rather than doing something about
it. Yeah, well, it's a terrible thing when you actually think about that at any length. I mean, you're having to put up with these ads, which is essentially, in some cases at least, contains a component of propaganda, and you're paying for it. You know, they don't even have the decency to pay for it themselves.
It adds insult to injury.
Yeah, and this becomes one of what you've described as I think the incumbency advantages, and that's what your bill seeks to address, isn't it? A number of these ways in which parties that are already there, and particularly if they're in government, can essentially just tweak things to their own advantage.
That's right. And I mean, I'm now an incumbent, so I stand to benefit from some of these incumbency advantages, but I still think that there needs to be a level playing field so others can come through.
So at the moment, as you would well know, there's the Electoral Matters Committee that has actually sort of started to address some of these issues. I mean, I guess where is that process up to, and why have you decided to sort of introduce this bill at this time?
So I sit mm-hmm. on the Electoral Matters Committee as the only lower house crossbencher to be in that role. So I sat through the evidence and the submissions and I actually contributed additional comments to the report that came out. And this bill basically embodies my additional comments in that report. There was also talk in the majority report about caps, donation caps and spending caps. And I started looking at, you know, how would we do this well, and realised the more and more I looked into how we would set caps, I realised it's really, really tough. And so I ended up saying, well, there is going to need to be further work done on that. But in the meantime, what are there are 13 changes here that have really broad support from the crossbench.
Yes, I was going to make that point, actually. It's an important one to make, that the other crossbenchers, people generally identified as Teal candidates, support this bill?
Well, yeah, but it's not just the Teal candidates. It's also Di Lee turned up yesterday. The Greens were there. Helen Haynes, David Pocock in the upper house. I spoke to Tammy Tyrrell, who was really comfortable with it. It has, you know, pretty broad right. support, but also democracy think tanks, civil society organisations, and we engaged deeply in developing the bill. In terms of the process from the Electoral Matters Committee, I met with Don Farrell yesterday, the Special Minister for State, and I will continue to meet with him on a regular basis to talk about these issues, these potential reforms, and ensure that some of those actually get included in the legislative response that the government has to that committee report. So, you know, it's in process, but there is a real danger with the setting of caps that you achieve the benefit of taking money out of politics, fantastic, but you actually create another problem because it's expensive to get your name out there, and name recognition is a big part of running a campaign. So there's a danger that if we set caps at the wrong level or with the wrong structure, it just embeds the two-party system and reduces political
or makes politics a rich person's game.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. A critical thing that needs to be considered, because you can't have a situation where someone who is, you know, a professional, for example, is able to plough a fair bit of money of their own money into a campaign, just starts well ahead of other worthy candidates who don't have that sort of don't come from that kind of wealthy background.
That's right. And I think Clive Palmer is sort of the example there, that everyone's pretty sure that we don't want a whole lot of that happening in our democracy.
No, we do not.
But even, I mean, I was in the very fortunate position that I could take 4 months off work without pay to run a quite short campaign. But there aren't very, you know, there aren't lots of people who can't take big chunks of time off work without pay.
Quite right. And we don't want the parliament to be made up of just one section of the community.
Exactly. Trying to level that out, yeah, I think, is a really important guiding principle that needs to drive the legislative response to the committee report.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Like, the implementation of some of these issues is actually really tricky, you know, and I mean, lots of people are really attracted to truth in advertising, but it is really difficult to actually implement. I mean, has the committee or your sort of the network of people around you actually got ideas about how to actually achieve that, for example?
Yeah, so the bill includes truth in advertising, and it uses the model that Zali Steggall developed and put into a private member's bill last year. And I agree it's difficult. And the big question, of course, with truth in advertising is who gets to decide what the truth is.
Indeed, yeah.
But there's a model that's being used in South Australia that seems to be working pretty well. I think if you do that model, no matter who ends up on that panel, and obviously it needs to be an independent panel or body, it needs to take a pretty conservative approach. So it would only look at things that are being held out as facts that can be proven to not be facts. And that conservative approach, I think, would build up faith over time.
Quickly could it act? Because you know, obviously within the dynamic environment of an election period, the period leading up to the campaign, the formal campaign itself, that's when, as we can see in this country right at the moment, and we can probably talk about The Voice a bit later, but you know, public opinions can be shaped by disinformation, by lies, by misrepresentations. If the sanction for that or the adjudication of it is some sort of machinery that needs to be swung into action and so forth, would this, I mean, we'll come back to donations as well, with the whole concept of real time matters, but would this be in real time?
Look, I don't know. I mean, I think this is the conversation that we need to be having. And no doubt whatever model we came up with would be imperfect, but I think it's got to be better than nothing, because at the moment, if you're running a business, you're not allowed to be misleading or deceptive. If you're running a political campaign, you can say whatever you like. And I think so, even though there will be challenges with implementation, we have to come back to those first principles that people actually should be able to believe that something held out to be a fact in a political campaign is a fact. So, you know, the real time or the responsiveness and agility of that would be one challenge, because we'd have to balance that against due process and appropriate research to make sure that it's not.
And freedom of expression. I mean, we look at what Trump's arguing at the moment in relation to the outrageous things he said in the aftermath of the election in 2020. And, you know, he's running the free speech defence. I mean, it's essentially the sort of foundation of his defence for all of the things, whether he said it to Mike Pence or leaning on governors to overturn results or find votes or whatever. His defence team is arguing he believed that the election had been stolen, that he had been the subject of malfeasance and rorting, and as a result of that, he was acting in good faith, and the Constitution guarantees free speech. We don't have the same kind of fundamentalism about those things, but we do have an implied right of free speech in political communication.
We do, and I don't think, you know, anyone wants to curb free speech, but there is a common sense approach that can be taken to that too. That if
there is, but I'm just thinking, if it's not real time, then it has to be balanced by serious sanction in sort of retrospect. So whilst you might not be hauled over the coals for certain misrepresentations you're making during an election debate or whatever it might be, you know, the next day or even before polling day, doing so knowingly, if it doesn't have any sort of serious penalty, it just, you know, if it doesn't result, for example, in overturning the election or some serious fine or whatever, and then of course you get into whole questions about, like with Trump, whether it's a lie if you truly believe it to be the case, you know, intent, the question of intent.
Absolutely. And what I would like to see is this conversation being had not just on podcasts but in Parliament. You know, let's actually have that discussion about balancing balancing these important principles against each other and coming up with something. And I think the South Australian model is a good place to start. You know, we've got something, we're trying it. It doesn't seem to be, you know, the world has not ended. Take it from there. But at least you know, do these things, do these common sense, and there are 13 reforms here that have, you know, broad support and seem like common sense. And so I see this as being a baseline for the sort of reform that we need, and we can thrash out the details. I believe the parliamentary process should make legislation better. I'm not saying this is perfect, but let's actually get in there and do it.
It's a lovely idea. and look, you know, to be fair, it does happen. It does happen quite a lot that the parliamentary process does improve bills. We see amendments made, in particularly in the Senate, you know, where the government needs votes to legislation, and those amendments very often are improvements as a result of different perspectives being brought in. So, yeah, it would be nice to see more private members' bills make it through those stages of debate and have those considerations added in, but it doesn't always occur, unfortunately, because going back to the point we were all making, the system's sort of skewed to favour those who are exercising power, and they tend to control the agenda in part.
Well, and realistically, they have actually. Like, I think the last two attempts at donation reform ultimately ended up in the two major parties colluding to make a deal that was a better fit for them.
Yeah, so that they could cop, yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. And I think that it can be disheartening to look at that. But then we have some fantastic examples like Helen Haines' integrity bill. Now, she put forward an integrity commission bill as a private member's bill, and it just influenced the conversation.
It did, and it sort of became, in a sense, formed a spine of what became the legislation in the end, although, interestingly, the government did a deal with the opposition there to get that through the lower house.
But it is a whole lot better than anything that was on the table before. And I think she, by introducing that private members' bill and saying, here is a thing that can be done, it means that the conversation can be about, well, why aren't we doing it like that? And you have a model to test other suggestions against.
Yeah. In real politic terms, like bills like this are, they demonstrate that Parliament does remain like an important platform, and it also, for anyone who wonders why you should vote for a non-party actor, it's a really good example of why that might be the case, because they might surface issues that are awkward for someone who is operating under party discipline, who is seeking and to achieve collective goals and aims.
It's a very good point. You'll probably find there's quite a few MPs on either side, backbenchers, sometimes perhaps even ministers, who privately agree with a number of these things but aren't able to speak because that's not their area within the party, or that's not the party policy. You know, there's a sort of a general line. So I think Parliament is just so vastly improved by the inclusion of new voices such as your own.
And Helen Haines yesterday made the point. She said, I defy any parliamentarian to actually argue against these 13 common sense reforms. Now, they won't have to if they're sitting on a backbench.
That's how they argue against it.
That's right.
They argue against it by making sure that it doesn't actually come to a full debate.
Exactly.
Let's take a quick break and be back in a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Democracy Sausage from the ANU. We're talking with Kate Chaney. Maria, fascinating kind of possibilities here with some of these reforms. Donation reform in particular is one, I think everyone understands this concept, the idea of money playing a role in politics. I think you say, Kate, that only 27% of money that funds the party, the major parties over recent years, is actually able to be attributed to known sources. Is that correct?
It's actually 21%.
21.
Yeah, and that's of private funding. So there's public funding, but of the money that doesn't come from government over the last 20 years, 21% of major parties' revenue has come from declared donations, where it actually identifies where it's
so
come
that's
from.
one in $5 is accountable.
That's
that
right.
Could mean that the other four, I mean theoretically it could mean that the other four all comes from donations under the declaration threshold.
Micro donations. Yeah, there's also it's divided into useful categories such as undisclosed and other receipts.
Very specific.
Also subscriptions, but that may include $35,000 subscriptions to a business forum.
Yeah.
So there really is an astonishing lack of transparency.
Could you, I mean, you talk about it being called dark money, but can you actually just tell listeners, like, what is actually kind of meant by that? Like, what are the ways or the means by which parties might raise money that isn't donating on the, you know, party's website?
Yeah, so there are a whole lot of different ways. And the problem is, you know, it's hard to know which are the biggest problems because it's entirely hidden. But we know that parties hold fundraising dinners where they charge $14,000 for your meal. Now, clearly, most of that is a donation and not payment for your beef or chicken. So, but it's not declared as that. Subscriptions to business forums or, you know, other sort of membership-based ideas or concepts that are really donations. Another thing that happens is donation splitting. So just below the radar, just below the threshold, which is now $16,300, and then putting it through different types of entities that are related to the party.
Or like donating $15,000 to each state division, for example.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. And there are about 70 or 80 separate entities that are part of the coalition. So theoretically, you could
actually... These are fundraising vehicles in a sense.
That's right.
Yeah. So 500 clubs, 200 clubs,
you
things
could
like
split
that.
You could donate more than $1 million, but split it into parcels of $14,000 to different entities, and it would be completely under the radar.
And we see in America they've got these public action committees that essentially are ways around this so that lots of money gets, you know, channeled into these things. And we've got sort of variations on that theme in Australia. And as you say, this tendency that the parties have, which is particularly useful in government, and think about that for a moment, you know, to hold dinners, for example, where business people can sit shoulder to shoulder with the treasurer or the prime minister for a significant wedge of dough and bend their ear about whatever it is that they would like to see out of government policy and build those relationships. And I ended up in the federal court myself after reporting or being involved in the reporting of one of these stories. The governments are quite sensitive about it, but I mean,
it doesn't pass the pub test.
Well, what worries me about it and worried me about it at the time is the notion that essentially we're paying these people's salary. This is our government. We're paying its salary, and the treasurer, the prime minister, you know, deputy prime minister, whoever it is, defence minister, all of these people are then essentially using that status and that power, the authority vested in them by the people and the parliament, to raise money for their political purposes.
And one example that I think sums up a lot of these issues is PwC traditionally has hosted the post-budget dinner that the government ministers all go to after the dinner. Now, PwC puts on the food and the venue, so their in-kind donation is relatively small. Tickets then become a donation to the government or the party that's in government at the time. And in exchange for those tickets, PwC clients who they offer the tickets to get to go and sit and talk to the treasurer just after he's handed down the budget. Now this is a win-win in terms of government and the host of the dinner, PwC in this case, but you wouldn't say it's a win for all of Australia. And I mean, I think we can make our own decisions about which of these things we think are okay, But transparency is a really good place to start.
Transparency is a terrific place to start, and real-time reporting of donations as well, which I suppose is the transparency. But that moment that people have to confront, which is when they write out the check or however it's done these days, they have to think, this will become public straight away.
That's right. And one of the things, so when I ran my campaign, you know, coming in with the freshness, I thought, well, of course people should be able to see where the money's come from. So we built a website in a week, and if you made a donation, it instantly appeared on the website. Now, you could tick a box to say that you wanted to remain anonymous, because that was what the law said, but 90% of my donors disclosed their name, and that just appeared in real time on my website. Now, there were journalists who were refreshing that and seeing who's given to the campaign now, and some scrutiny that came with that, that my opponent had zero scrutiny. Mm. I was shocked to find out that you don't find out even the small proportion of disclosed donations until, in this case, 10 months after the election, when it's way too late to decide whether it's going to affect who you vote for.
Sometimes it's longer.
We all remember when Malcolm Turnbull donated $1.75 million of his own money in that 2016 election campaign, and it was, I think it was 10 months or 14 months.
Even 18 months later, yeah.
Yeah, that we found out about that donation. And I think it's fair to say, and I remember writing this at the time, that would have been, because it was among the largest donations to a political party from an individual in Australian history at that time. I think people would have been interested to know about that in the context of the election campaign, but it was not required to be declared in any way until January of the following year, I think.
So if people want to vote for someone who's getting their money from gambling companies or fossil fuel companies, you know, that's their choice, but they need to actually have that choice and know before they vote.
Yeah.
So that just seems like complete common sense to me, and I can't believe that there's any resistance to that, and it hasn't been done.
So you're proposing that the donations threshold go from the current 16,300, I think it is, to 1,000.
Yeah, to 1,000, and to be disclosed within 5 business days. Now, we've said 5 business days because, you know, I understand that there's an administrative burden to actually disclosing that, but it really shouldn't be that hard, and I think it's a pretty reasonable request that parties manage their infrastructure in a way that makes that possible.
Oh, yes, I'm sure if they wanted to that they could. And one of the other ones I'm sort of interested in here is to prohibit unions and various corporate entities from making donations without member or shareholder approval. Would that also sort of, I guess, affect Australia's equivalent of PACs, you know, so Climate 200? How might that impact, I guess, the timeliness of donations?
Yeah, interestingly, half of all OECD countries ban corporate donations full stop. Now, in Australia, there's some doubt about whether that might raise constitutional issues to ban corporate donations entirely. So this is really a compromise position to say, well, at least it should be done with member approval, whether it's union members or corporate shareholders. It doesn't quite deal with the PAC model because presumably the mischief that this aims for is companies or unions making donations that may not have the consent of their members where the money mm-hmm. comes from. Presumably in a PAC, people who give to that PAC know that the purpose of the donation is to actually make those donations. So it's a bit of a different mm-hmm. issue. But this seems like a reasonable compromise on, you know, for corporations. And the UK requires this, that you get shareholder approval before making political donations. In the UK, it has greatly reduced the number of corporate donations, because when you have to sit down and explain to your shareholders what benefit you hope to gain from making political donations, things can get a bit awkward.
Does it apply to, would it apply, should it apply to issues like the one the country faces at the moment that in relation to the referendum, or would it just apply to election campaigns and electoral matters? Because we wouldn't want to see a situation, unless you're perhaps Peter Dutton, where companies aren't able to make donations in respect of the environment, in respect of this critical question of social national unity and advancement that we're facing with The Voice. I mean, Dutton complains about woke corporates and, of course, the Libs have long complained about Labor having this conduit of money flowing to it from the unions. So at some levels you would expect the Conservatives to kind of like this proposal because, you know, it would place some requirements on unions, for example, on Labor to secure from unions the approval to have those dues that have long funded the Labor Party.
Well, that's right, and I guess you can't have it both ways. You know, if you object to, I mean, the example that you give about the referendum, I think it's an interesting one, and you know, this reform is really focused on election campaigns because I think buying influence with government is the mischief that we're trying to solve here.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, but on something like The Voice, if someone says yes, that should also apply to referenda, then you'd have to say that they will have to also be comfortable with getting shareholder approval for all corporate donations. So some, you know, consistency.
Yeah.
I mean, in the case of companies that have donated to The Voice, I think if they did have to get shareholder approval, they probably would because it's consistent with their long-term commitments to reconciliation.
Yeah, I think that's right, but it's an interesting one.
I guess one of the things that I'm quite interested in around the sort of level of the playing field is the sort of issues raised around independent campaigns versus political party campaigns. So I suppose, you know, from your perspective as an independent, you know, what barriers to entry are you sort of facing that you want to see levelled?
Mm. And the problem with this stuff is it's pretty technical and, you know, gets a bit boring. So I think, you know, one of the challenges is actually communicating that it is an uneven playing field, which is made up of the death by a thousand cuts, lots of little barriers that are put in place. So, for example, when you're running a campaign, as I learned, you eventually get access to the electoral roll. And it's a big, you know, you can now come in and get the electoral roll. So I went into the city and picked it up and it's a big fat book with names and addresses in it. But if you're the incumbent, you've got an electronic version of that, which makes it much easier to actually contact voters. We didn't really know what to do with this big telephone book without telephone numbers in it. And so those sorts of barriers, so the things that make it harder to access voters. Similarly, the timing of the exemption from the Do Not Call register is different if you're an independent or if you're in a party. And the when you have to report is different as well. So there are all these little administrative barriers. And so one of the things in the bill is to develop the idea of an independent campaign entity that effectively attracts all the benefits that are built into a political party entity once you reach a certain threshold. So, for example, you show that you've got the support of 100 voters in the electorate to run, just so that you're not starting, you know, with a disadvantage from the very beginning.
I mean, this is interesting to me at least. And I guess my devil's advocate question is, you know, cranks, right? Like lots of people run as independents in campaigns and most of them are not as storied as yourself, for example. I suppose, you know, is there a risk in creating such easy access to the electoral roll as just one consideration that we might actually create a worse problem for voters in particular?
It's definitely an issue that we thought about. And I think, you know, I'm very open to discussions about what that hurdle should be. But the idea would be create one hurdle to prove your legitimacy and your broad support, and then make it a level playing field rather than having all these different hurdles for all these different aspects of running a campaign. So, for example, you wouldn't want a real estate agent to be able to register as an independent and then get access to the electoral roll. At the moment, AEC says most of the people who come in and check the electoral roll are real estate agents. So it's already there, but it's a more manual process.
Yeah.
But I think by requiring a minimum number of signatures and a stat deck that you intend to run, then we can try and ensure that we find the balance between allowing competition in our political environment, but also, avoiding unintended consequences.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I think that kind of goes to show to some of the changes that have been made to obtaining party status, i.e. making it harder because of this sort of problem of the proliferation of all of these sort of micro parties. And there is an interesting kind of dynamic right now which exists where someone like yourself needs to find 100 people to say that you're a bona fide independent candidate. But anyone running under one of our smaller parties at the moment, like Centre Alliance or One Nation or the United Australia Party, doesn't, because they have party status, and you can kind of see how that may be an issue.
And that's another thing that is addressed in the bill, is that registration of new candidates would require 100 signatures as well, whether you're an independent or you're in a party, so that people can't be either parachuted in if they don't have any community support, or, as we saw in the last electorate, just random names put on the ticket that no one's ever heard of or seen through the whole of the campaign. So proving a minimum level of community support should be a prerequisite whether you're in a party or not.
Look, it's been really terrific to hear about this. Can we just go quickly before we let you go to a couple of other issues? One is I just wanted to get your sense of how you think the Parliament's working sitting there in the lower house. There was a lot of talk at the start of the new Parliament about, you know, lifting it above the tone, above what it had been in previous terms. It's got pretty robust at times. Of course, that's fair enough. It's a sort of an adversarial chamber in a sense. But what's your feeling about how it is, and also the extent to which the crossbench has access? I see quite a few crossbench questions get asked, much more than was the case in the past. Are crossbenchers generally happy with the participation they get in question time, for example?
Yeah, so I'll do the second bit first. The allocation of questions is very much linked to the size of our representation in Parliament. So it's all mathematically valid. And so we get 3 questions in each question time. Mm. And I think we're happy with that, and that seems fair. In terms of how the Parliament's operating, I think we got off to a pretty good start. And I've been fairly happy with it. Question time still leaves a huge amount to be desired.
It certainly does.
And I'm working with other crossbenchers. We're working through all the appropriate processes to try to get some improvements made to question time.
This, incidentally, is another one that we could have mentioned, the way of the advantages of incumbency. I mean, political parties that are not in power, you know, that are in opposition, like to talk or at least flirt with the idea of question time reform. But when you're in power, they take all the advantages of incumbency and all of those Dorothy Dixes that get asked, which are a waste of time and which are a sort of a kabuki play, a pantomime that we have to all sit through. They just extend the whole thing out. If you look at question time in the House of Commons, for example, it's very rapid fire. You know, the questions are short, the answers are short, and they come sometimes in sustained patches from just the opposition leader and then from around the house, and people are genuinely jockeying, trying to stand up to get the speaker's attention. Ours is highly formulaic, rigid. It's, this sort of alternating from side to side of the house thing, and it's just another advantage of incumbency, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the fundamental principle behind question time is a good one, that government should have to be accountable and be able to respond to issues of the day.
And that the chief executive, the prime minister or the president, and I say that because this is one of the problems with the US system, where the president is never accountable. Mm. And it's just such a ridiculous system. Our system actually does, at least on paper, work.
Yeah, that's right. But then being the first day sitting in question time, I was exchanging looks with my fellow new crossbenchers. And I was literally thinking, I cannot believe I'm going to have to sit through this every single day, because it just is completely different to the vibe of most of the rest of what happens in Parliament. I sit on committees that are pretty collaborative and civil, and then it turns into this theatre of attack. And on the floor, there's a lot of mushering and you know, jeering. Chipping people and jeering and laughing
banter,
and right. stuff that you would not get away with in any other context in
It's really
in Australian
good
society.
That primary school children are taken to watch it too.
It is, although you can't really, you have to actually be down on the floor to hear most of it. In the front row of the where the press gallery sits, you can pick up a fair bit that doesn't get picked up on television. Mm. But I've spoken to colleagues of yours, but also some of the parliamentary staff, the Hansard people, and these are types who are sitting on the floor, and they say what you can hear, you know, when you're down in the middle there is even another level, and that's what you're referring to, I guess.
And I don't think it does anything for rebuilding people's faith in our democratic system. We should be having sensible, substantive questions about things that we need information on rather than, as you say, the Dorothy Dixes of tell us why the government's great coming from one side.
Yeah.
And then what we usually see is a political attack theme of the day with a whole lot of questions, you know, pushing, really asking the same question 20 yeah. different ways. Mm. I might be biased, but I reckon you do get the three crossbench questions in there that actually are seeking answers.
Is it designed, do you think, that culture, if a culture can be said to be in charge of design, but is it designed to sort of intimidate? Is it an intimidatory atmosphere on the floor of the House?
Oh, I think it's theatre and it's letting off steam and it's a bit of...
role-playing almost.
Yeah, a bit of role-play and people who have been there for a long time say, oh, come on, you know, it's a bit of fun. That's the culture. That's how it is. But being part of a group who are new to it, we do think, well, this could just be done so much better. So we'll keep prosecuting that and keep trying to drive improvements. But as any culture change, it will take a long time and we'll have to keep chipping it away at it.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is just on the voice. And there's been a particular focus in your home state of WA on those heritage laws. I can't say that I fully understand those laws, but they've only been in 5 weeks and they're now being rescinded again because I think, you know, there's a pretty bad kind of intersection between the political criticism of that and the voice, which is, of course, a federal issue and completely separate, but they tended to be conflated.
And the waters have been very muddied. The Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Act in WA, there's been an obligation for 40 years in WA not to damage significant cultural sites. And then we had Juukan Gorge, and so there was obviously a need to change something because they weren't working properly. The intent of the Act was to actually simplify that process, but I think because it wasn't being enforced previously, it feels like it's new obligations. The rollout was not managed well.
But you've got, we were talking before about misinformation and disinformation. There's been a lot of deliberate mischief making, hasn't there?
Absolutely.
About these laws being able to be used to take people's backyards and
absolutely.
This kind of stuff.
And a lot of, you know, there are media stories saying this tree planting event was stopped because of the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Act, which was just completely not
wrong.
True.
Bollocks, yeah.
So the combination of confusion plus intentional misinformation has meant it's a little bit of a mess. And I think it's the right decision to pull back and start that process more collaboratively because it was really muddying the waters on what is a much bigger issue, and that is the voice to Parliament.
At an event I was doing with Megan Davis in recent days, someone stood up and said they'd just come back from WA, and this person said everyone they spoke to was hostile about the voice and either didn't understand it and was proposing to vote against it or did understand it and was mentioning heritage laws and other kinds of things, you know, basically a whole lot of spurious arguments. Do you have a sense? I mean, it's hard. I know this is just a guess in a way, but do you have a sense about the culture of WA being different from perhaps other places, more hostile to this change?
Oh, I think definitely the recent Cultural Heritage Act hasn't helped because it's sort of created fear and confusion. And there is a lot of misinformation out there. The thing that I've found in door knocking and having conversations is a lot of people just haven't turned their mind to it at all, really, and they will in the weeks before it's coming up. And when you actually get a chance to talk to someone and talk about the evidence that a lot of the scare campaigns are just not accurate, what I find is people can take a pretty common sense approach. I mean, and something that I find resonates is we are really bad at developing policy to address the issues of colonisation and support Aboriginal people. when you're really bad at something, you get advice.
Mm-hmm.
This is a committee that can give advice, and it is actually that simple. And so I think there is cut through when people have those conversations, but there's work to be done in cutting through all the noise, all the fear. And fear is much easier to spread than hope. But I think as we come closer to the referendum, people will think about it more, and I think that common sense will prevail.
So you still have a level of confidence about this?
Yeah, I do.
Do you think, just very quickly, the government has done well so far, or would you like to have seen more energy, more front-footedness from the government?
Oh, it's really tricky because I do think that the thing about a referendum is that it's not about politicians. It is about people. But
no change has happened in this country before of any significance without political leadership. And this does not have bipartisan support. So.
No, and that is a real problem. I mean, I think the lack of bipartisan support is very, very sad. And I cannot understand the rationale of the Liberal Party to take this angle. I don't think it's driven by a genuine belief on the substance. I think it is driven by political
opportunism,
and I think that will backfire in a big way. Whether the country decides yes or no, I don't think it's going to be a good political outcome for the opposition. What I have liked seeing is the community level support and volunteer groups building up around the country. As I found out in my campaign, I had no one with any political experience in my campaign.
Is that right?
Yeah, grassroots campaigning is shambolic and messy, and you work it out as you go along and you make mistakes, and it might take a while to get off the ground. But there are people all over the country who want to help out, want to get involved, and I think that that momentum will build over time.
Kate, it's been a great pleasure having you on Democracy Sausage. I'm already looking forward to the next time we have you on. It's been a really terrific conversation.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Kate.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. I look forward to talking to you again next week. Until then, bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.